Hi there, dolls, music lovers, and fashion enthusiasts. Welcome to Unveiling the Legends, Dolls of the 60s and 70s, the podcast that takes you on a groovy journey through the lives and legacies of the incredible women who shaped these iconic decades. We are your hosts, Emma
and Abby,
and together we'll explore the stories behind the music, the fashion, and the cultural revolution that defined an era.
Each episode will shine a spotlight on a remarkable woman, from rock and roll rebels to fashion icons, and dive into their impact on the world. We'll uncover the historical context, chat with experts, and celebrate the lasting influence of these trailblazing ladies. So, grab your bell bottoms and get ready to rock and roll as we uncover the untold stories of dolls who left their mark. Let's dive in.
Whenever we say that intro part, I have the music playing in the back of my head. I'm like shimmying around to it.
I do like the little hand
yeah, and I saw too. You move too, and I was like, oh yeah, it's in my head too.
We're on the same wavelength.
Yes.
Tell us about your birthday dinner.
It was great. I turned 26 on Sunday.
Yay!
I decided to have some friends over Saturday night, and I've always wanted to host a murder mystery dinner. Because I always see them and I always heard about them, and I thought it was such a cool idea. So you basically assign characters before inviting everyone, and then everyone comes dressed in their character. And I decided to go with a 1920s theme. Mm-hmm. And so everyone came in their like suits and flapper outfits. And then you have the different characters. And the story was everyone's at this party and one of the people there is dead all of the sudden. And so then you had to find out who of us, like someone in the group, was the murderer. It was pretty good.
It's kind of like the board game Clue.
Yes. Kind of like that, but like a little more...
like an immersive experience.
Yes. It was a lot of fun. We had a 1920s dinner. We like tried to get some recipes. I, for the first time in my life, had stuffed celery, which wasn't all that bad.
Stuffed with what?
Like cream cheese, and then you also put olives in, and like a little bit of seasoning. And because it is shaped, like it's kind of like hollow in the middle, you just put
it
there.
Yeah, it's like a boat.
It was great. I can recommend it. Good snack.
I do that with peanut butter and raisins. It's called ants on a log here. I don't know if you have ants on a log in Germany.
Never heard of it, but I like it with peanut butter. I don't like raisins that much. I don't know about that.
Yeah, ants on a log is like a prime preschool snack.
That's so sweet.
And a dirt cup pudding with Oreos crumbled and a little gummy worm.
That is so fun.
Love that.
That's fun food. I love it.
So I was digging through, I just remember this, I was digging through my stuff the other weekend because I am a sentimental pack rat and I keep literally everything. I was like, why is this receipt from a bookstore here? I thought I lost these headphones 5 years ago. It's actually kind of a problem. But I found in here, what can you tell me about this package?
No way. Oh my God. That brings back the memories.
I told you I hang on to everything.
That's so sweet.
For those of you at home who listen but cannot see, I bought a few dresses from Emma a couple years ago, I think.
Yes.
Maybe it was longer. I don't know. But Emma drew, this is like a brown paper bag packaging, and she drew all these lovely swirls and lines on it and wrote my name in this really pretty calligraphy. And I kept it because
that's
it was
so
just
sweet.
Such a nice gesture.
I love it. That's so funny. I had no idea. I always thought everyone just threw them out. And so at one point I was like, why do I even bother making the packaging so pretty? But I'm like that too. I hold on to things. So I completely get it. But I feel very honored.
Everything is always connected, isn't it?
Back then, I could have never imagined we would sit here a couple years later. Isn't that so wild?
It is. Speaking of everything is always connected, take it away, Emma.
Today's episode is very close and dear to my heart. It's about a woman whose voice, life, and music is as fascinating as tragic. A woman who didn't only change music and the role of women within the industry, but also stands for the 1960s counterculture like none other. I have a personal connection with her since the both of us are sharing the same birthday, January 19th, something that has always made me feel especially close to her. Today we're going to talk about the legendary Janis Joplin. Today's episode mainly comes from a couple of books I've read on Janis over the past couple of years. Janis by Holly George Warren, Pearl, The Obsession and Passion of Janis Joplin by Alice Embern, and Buried Alive, The Biography of Janis Joplin by Myra Friedman, as well as some inserts of Peggy Caserta's books, Going Down with Janis, and I Ran Into Some Trouble, which are definitely more legends than the truth, but more on that later.
This is why we do what we do, to separate fact from fiction.
Yes.
Our story begins on June 17th, 1967, with the Monterey Pop Festival in California. On day two, a relatively unknown band took the stage, Big Brother and the Holding Company, fronted by Janis Joplin.
This group we'd like to bring on now because of the great acceptance they had on Saturday afternoon. From San Francisco on Mainstream Records, let's hear it for Big Brother and the Holding Company.
She screams, wails, and sings to bluesy guitar riffs, so emotionally charged many had never heard a woman sing like this before. Like Jimi Hendrix and Jim Morrison, Janis Joplin would go on to become a legend. Her meteoric career, spanning just 4 years, transformed a rebellious girl into a global star. Her uncompromising nature made her music so authentic, but her lifestyle would destroy her body early on. Her singing embodied the spirit of change of the 1960s. Her music and presence rebelled against traditional gender roles and racial segregation in the United States. With a voice like hers, audiences weren't quite prepared for what they heard. On stage, she could explode with energy or lose herself completely in her songs. Her performances were not just concerts, but raw emotional experiences, a fusion of pain, passion, and sheer power that captivated anyone who listened. With every note, Janis defied conventions, proving that music could be a vessel for freedom, individuality, and the complexity of the human spirit.
On January 19th in 1943, 56 years before me, Janis Lynn Joplin was born in the coastal town of Port Arthur, Texas, as the first child of the Joplin family. Her mother, Dorothy Bonita East, was a registrar at a business college who was already 30 years old when she had Janis, her first child, something rather rare for the 1940s. Her husband and Janis' father, Seth Ward Joplin, already in his mid-30s, was an engineer at Texaco. The family lived in Port Arthur, a provincial town with about 45,000 residents in southeastern Texas, near the Louisiana border. It resembled a sprawling industrial site with drive-in theaters and soda stands. The numerous oil refineries filled the air with exhaust and foul odors. Most of the white residents of Port Arthur worked in the refineries, and they were conservative and often racist. Janis' parents were the typical American middle-class folks, the friendly family next door. No one, and above all not the Joplins, would have imagined that their daughter would go on to make history, with her voice, revolutionary music, and a life so far off from everything Port Arthur knew. For 6 years, Janis was an only child, until her sister Laura and brother Michael were born. The Joplins encouraged and supported their children. Clever and academically strong, Janis skipped the second grade. She sang in the church choir, where her clear soprano voice soon earned her recognition. Although her parents fostered her talents, family life at the Joplins' house wasn't warm or particularly loving. Janis' friends described her mother Dorothy as strict, moralistic, critical, and cold.
Her mom reminds me of the warden.
Yes.
A really strict, kind of hardened lady. And parents like that usually beget rebellious, really strong-spirited children.
Yeah, that's interesting. Her father, Seth, whom Janice called a closeted intellectual, was reclusive but served as a role model for his daughter. In a town where everyone wore the same clothes and did the same things, her father was the only one she knew who was a little different, and Janice, who had always felt like she didn't belong, looked up to him.
Things changed for Janice in her adolescence. She became an unpopular outsider, largely because of her appearance. She developed acne, gained weight, and was considered unattractive by her peers. She went through an awkward phase. Happens to the best of us.
Oh, it truly does.
In her book, author Alice Eccles quotes one of Janice's school friends. When you turn 14 in Port Arthur, Texas, as a girl, it was like entering a sort of sexual competition. If you didn't have much to show for it, you were out of luck. The popular girls were pretty, but Janice wasn't. She was relentlessly teased for being different. Instead of going out on dates or to parties, Janice spent her time reading, painting, and advocating for the end of racial segregation. Among her peers, she earned a reputation, rightly or wrongly, as a promiscuous bad girl. Other kids thought she was strange, mocking her with cruel names like pig, freak, and creep. In response, Janice rebelled. She cast aside the traditional white blouses and full skirts of the 1950s, opting either for a miniskirt or loose, baggy clothing. She immersed herself in the works of Jack Kerouac and Allen Ginsberg. Both were prominent figures of the Beatnik movement, the American counterpart to the French existentialists. Both thinkers were integral to what would become hippie culture. To those who ask what my one-sided beef with Jan Wenner is about, this is it. Because a couple years ago, Jan said something to the effect of, "I didn't include interviews with Janice," keyword with women, "in my new book because I wanted to feature articulate, intelligent people." Janice was, in fact, very well read.
Yes.
And he included an interview with Dylan, who is famously not the most articulate guy. Oh boy. Music became Janice's passion and how she expressed nonconformity. Janice and her few new friends primarily listened to folk, jazz, and blues, all genres that would never be played at a high school dance or a sock hop. They dismissed the rock and roll of the time as being too commercial. Instead, their idols were black blues musicians. Janice responded most to the Empress of Blues, Bessie Smith, whose gravestone she'd later fund, Lead Belly, and the Queen of Folk, Odetta. While singing along to Odetta's records, Janice discovered the power of her own voice. Quote, "She just let loose and sounded exactly like Odetta," recalls a friend of Janice. "It exposed us all. We used to sing folk songs whenever we drove somewhere. Well, we still did that afterward, but it wasn't the same anymore. We weren't in the same league anymore. She seems to have found a release for her anger, pain, and energy through singing." Janice graduated from Thomas Jefferson High School as part of the class of 1960. She knew exactly what she wanted to do after school. Quote, "Anyone with ambitions like mine leaves Port Arthur as quickly as possible. Otherwise, you get trapped, suppressed, and beaten down." She reflected on her time in high school while on the Dick Cavett Show in 1970. This is what she said.
"You ever get back to Port Arthur, Texas?"
"No, but I'm going back next in August, man. I guess what I'm doing.
I don't know. Nightclubbing
there? I'm going to my 10th annual high school reunion.
I want to take movies and bring them back here."
"Hey,
and
would you like to go, man?"
"Well, I don't remember. I don't have that many friends in your high school class."
"I don't either."
"Or mine, for that matter."
"I don't either, believe me."
"You don't either? You, what,
that's
you
why
were,
I'm
going. Weren't you kind of a... And do you think you'll have a lot to say to your old high school classmates?"
"I'm going to laugh a lot, man."
"Were you not surrounded by friends in high school?"
"They laughed me out of class, out of town, and out of the state." "So I'm going home."
"How do you know? How do you know they won't move the reunion now that you're going to ask them?"
"That's true. I wasn't going to tell them."
She got into Lamar University and took odd jobs, working for a telephone company, singing in bars, waitressing, and occasionally attending college. Eventually, Beaumont, Texas wasn't the place to be either, so Janice moved to Austin, where she enrolled in the University of Texas. There, she and her friends formed the core of the counterculture group, about 200 men and women on a campus of 20,000 students. Psychedelic drugs, free sexuality, rejection of materialism, and vehement opposition to racial segregation were the group's principles. However, Janice also used drugs to suppress her self-doubt. She self-medicated herself and started drinking heavily. The campus newspaper, The Daily Texan, which she also used to sell on campus, ran a profile on her in the issue dated July 27, 1962, headlined, quote, "She dares to be different." The article began, quote, "She goes barefooted when she feels like it, wears Levi's to class because they're more comfortable, and carries her autoharp with her everywhere she goes so that in case she gets the urge to break into a song, it will be handy. Her name is Janice Joplin." She joined Lenny Wiggins, who unfortunately I couldn't find anything about, and Powell St. John, who later wrote a couple of songs for the psychedelic sounds of the 13th Floor Elevator, the 13th Floor Elevator's debut album. The two of them had a folk duo called the Waller Creek Boys. They were playing bluesgrass, blues, country, and folk music, mostly performing in the backyards of student ghettos. A friend, Freda Sloat, recalls, quote, "Janice was one of those people who practiced late into the night to perfect every single phrase of her transition from one chord to the next. They were all fanatics. You have to be a fanatic to be an artist, and she certainly was." Janice rejected formal vocal training, saying, quote, "They only want me to sing differently." She started performing regularly at Threat Grills, a venue packed with fans. As the main attraction, she didn't even need a microphone to outshine the other musicians. The audience was electrified. Something new was happening. Gradually, Austin's perception shifted, with the eccentricity of the folkies becoming hip and cool. This was the first time in Janice's life she was considered cool outside of her friend group, and she also started to believe that this whole music thing could really work out for her. In January 1963, Janice left Texas, hitchhiking with her friend Chet Helms to North Beach, San Francisco, to escape the constraints of her conservative upbringing. Quote, "just to get away," she later explained. Quote, "because my head was in a much different place." In San Francisco, the mecca of American counterculture, she began performing in clubs and bars, gaining recognition as a singer and immersing herself in the burgeoning music scene. It seemed like during this period she developed a rebellious persona, or maybe let the one she always had take over. Inspired partly by her female blues heroines and partly by the beat poets whose work she admired, and began carving out a path that would later define her as one of the most iconic voices of her generation.
Janice's first recorded song, What Good Can Drinkin' Do, was taped in December of 1962 at the home of a fellow UTexas student.
This is a song called What Good Can Drinkin' Do that I wrote one night after drinking myself into a stupor.
What good can drinkin' do?
At a hootenanny in San Jose in the fall of 62, Janice met Jorma Kaukonen, later of Jefferson Airplane and Hot Tuna. Over the next few years, Janice often called Jorma to join her at gigs. As they played together, the Bay Area's music scene evolved into the iconic San Francisco movement we know today. During a rehearsal for North Beach show, Jorma set up his reel-to-reel recorder to capture their work. He recorded Janice's beautiful voice while he played guitar. Jorma's wife, Margareta, typed in the background. These recordings were later released as bootleg album The Typewriter Tape.
Mm-hmm.
While it may have just been a rehearsal, it means so much more to the Janis canon. It includes both blues standards and her original songs. It serves as a glimpse into two artists at the dawn of their influential careers. As Yorma wrote in the liner notes of the bootleg's official release, "This is indeed a window into a simpler time when the music truly was everything." However, Janis's time in San Francisco took a toll on her health. She became involved in drugs. She tried just about everything, but favored speed. It indulged her energetic personality and fueled her performances. Janis also drank heavily, developing a fondness for Southern comfort. By 1965, Janis's drug use had escalated to the point where friends described her as skeletal and emaciated. Concerned for her welfare, they threw her a bus fare party and persuaded her to go back home to Texas. Janis actually tried having a life back home. She returned to Port Arthur and tried to adhere to the norms of her middle-class upbringing. She avoided drugs and alcohol, wore a beehive hairdo — I would love to see that, I cannot imagine Janis Joplin in a beehive — and gained weight. She enrolled at Lamar University, where she majored in anthropology or social work, according to differing accounts. Not sure how the university lost her transcripts like that. That makes me terrified for my own.
I have no idea. I tried to find like a definite account of what she studied, because I felt like there has to be a record somewhere.
Literally, yes.
Yes, but like there isn't even a record about whether she graduated with any degree or anything. So maybe that is why. I don't know.
Did the university burn down or something? What was there an earthquake? What happened?
I don't know.
It seemed that this was Janice's final try at a normal life, one last attempt to fit in at Port Arthur. But Janis couldn't let go of her music, the one thing that always welcomed her. So during this time, Janis commuted to Austin to perform. One notable performance was at a benefit for ailing bluesman Mance Lipscomb. In the fall of 1965, Janis got engaged. I had no idea she had ever been engaged before.
I feel like this first part of her career, the first time that she went to San Francisco, and then the part where she got engaged to Peter, is very much overseen nowadays. I feel like people very much focus on the second time she started having a career. And I think it is really interesting, because I didn't know about a lot of this either, but it is documented. And she had like this first attempt at a career that, although it didn't work out, revealed a lot about herself.
Peter and Janis started dating toward the end of her first stint in San Francisco. They did the long distance relationship thing for a time. Peter worked for IBM out in New York. He visited Port Arthur to ask Janice's father for her hand in marriage. She and her mom began planning a wedding. However, the engagement was short-lived. Peter broke it off. Around the same time, Janis sought counseling from a psychiatric social worker named Bernard Geritano. Bernard later revealed that Janis was deeply conflicted about pursuing a career in music, fearing a relapse. She often brought her acoustic guitar to their sessions, and her singing could be heard throughout the building.
For me, that's the tragic of her life. It almost feels like she knew what was coming for her when she would pursue music, but she also couldn't stay away from it. She knew it would lead to her destroying herself, but she also knew she could never be her true self outside of being a musician.
I find it really cool that in the 60s, they had Janis basically do not so much talk therapy, but singing therapy.
She really got lucky with that therapist, I think, because all accounts about this were really positive.
Again, taught her a lot about herself.
Yeah.
Despite Janis's attempts at a normal life, she remained deeply connected to music. She continued writing and recording songs, including an early version of Turtle Blues, and a recording of Buffy St. Marie's Codeine. These tracks, recorded about a year before she joined Big Brother and the Holding Company, were later released as the album This is Janis Joplin 1965. Unfortunately, Janis's time in Texas couldn't quite quell her desire to return to music. Her attempts at conformity were short-lived, and she soon found herself drawn back to California.
In 1966, Janis' bluesy vocal style caught the attention of the San Francisco psychedelic rock band Big Brother and the Holding Company. Promoter Chet Helms, who had hitchhiked with Janis years earlier, suggested she join the band. He sent his friend Travis Rivers to find her in Austin, where she was performing solo. Rivers accompanied her to San Francisco, but insisted she first visit her parents in Port Arthur to inform them of her plans. Janis assured them she was heading to Austin instead, before completing the the trip to San Francisco.
It was so easy to do that back then.
Yes. No geotag, no nothing.
No, no find my iPhone.
Janis officially joined Big Brother on June 4th in 1966. The band formed a year earlier with Sam Andrew and James Gurley on guitars, Peter Albin on bass, and Dave Getz on drums was a key part of the San Francisco music scene, known for their improvisational jazz-inspired style. They played their first show with Janis at the Avalon Ballroom, where they were the house band. Shortly after, Janis informed her parents of her move through a letter. Determined to stay sober, she initially resisted San Francisco drug culture, sharing an apartment with Rivers and agreeing to avoid needle use. However, tensions arose as drug use among her circle persisted, leading to an emotional confrontation when she caught guests injecting at her home, including an outdoor solstice concert. They all lived in a house together in California, often socializing with members of the Grateful Dead. During this time, Janis briefly dated Ron Pigpen McKernan, a founding member of the Grateful Dead.
Janis and Pigpen. That makes sense in my head.
Yes, I thought so too.
Both blues devotees.
I don't know, it kind of works for me.
Yeah.
Apparently it ended quite soon. In August 1966, the band played a four-week engagement in Chicago, but were stranded after the promoter ran out of money. This led them to sign with Mainstream Records, though early recordings made there failed to capture their live energy. Returning to San Francisco, they recorded tracks like Blind Man and All Is Loneliness, released as a single to little success. By late 1966, they switched managers from Chet Helms to Julius Carpen. In January 1967, Janis and Big Brother performed at the Mantra Rock Dance, a benefit for the Hare Krishna Temple, alongside Allen Ginsberg, Moby Grape, and the Grateful Dead. Around this time, Janis began a relationship with Country Joe McDonald of Country Joe and the Fish, briefly living with him in her San Francisco apartment. The band continued to play extensively at venues like the Fillmore West, Avalon Ballroom, and Winterland, as well as in Los Angeles, Seattle, Vancouver, and Boston. But their big break didn't come until one fateful gig in June of 1967.
The Monterey Pop Festival was a pivotal moment for many iconic 60s groups, including Big Brother. Monterey catapulted them and Janis out of the underground and into stardom. Sharing the stage with Jimi Hendrix, The Who, and Otis Redding, Big Brother delivered an electrifying set. Janis's rendition of Big Mama Thornton's Ball and Chain was the standout. Her raw, powerful voice and emotional intensity captivated the crowd. It perfectly captured the spirit of the times, blending bluesy grit with psychedelic energy. Luckily, it was filmed for the Monterey Pop documentary. I have that on DVD. It's such a good watch.
Yes.
It showed Janis's performance to a national audience, solidifying her star status.
Some came along on the grand old army, and it fell like a ball and chain.
It also captured Cass Elliot of the Mamas and Papas mouthing, "Oh, wow," during Big Brother's set. Cass was just one of many in awe of this new band and their incredible talent. Columbia Records president Clive Davis recalled, quote, "Big Brother took the stage, and this howling dervish, vibrating, exhilarating, electrifying Janis Joplin took the stage. And it clicked in me that whatever the fortune, the luck that brought me unsuspectingly to where I was sitting, I'd never signed an artist, I was a lawyer and was made president overnight. It did click in that this is my moment." Following the festival, Mainstream released Big Brother's self-titled album. While it received little attention initially, Columbia later re-released it, adding single Down On Me and prominently featuring Janis on the cover. For the remainder of 1967, Big Brother mostly stayed in California. They began an East Coast tour in February of 68 in Philadelphia and made their New York City debut at the Anderson Theater. On April 7th, just 3 days after Martin Luther King Jr.'s assassination, Big Brother performed at the Wake for Martin Luther King Jr. concert. Jimi Hendrix, Buddy Guy, Joni Mitchell, and Richie Havens played as well. One fateful night, Janis met The Doors' singer and Dolls Pod Bingo star, Jim Morrison. The Doors producer Paul Rothchild introduced them. He believed they could make an extraordinary pair. Paul invited Jim and Janis to a party in Hidden Hills. He suggested that they arrive sober so they could remember their introduction. Both complied initially, but it wasn't long before they slipped into their usual party personas. Janis and Jim hit it off at first, drawn to each other's raw energy and larger-than-life personalities. However, as the night wore on and the drinks flowed, Jim's behavior took a turn. Paul later described him as, quote, a cretin, a disgusting drunk, falling into a pattern of obnoxious and aggressive conduct. Janis, unimpressed, asked Paul to take her home, eager to escape the unraveling scene. As she prepared to leave, Jim's advances grew more insistent. He wasn't going to take no for an answer. When she denied him yet again, Jim reportedly grabbed her by the hair, attempting to pull her out of her car. In a swift and decisive response, Janis reached for a bottle of Southern Comfort and hit Jim over the head, leaving him sprawled on the ground with a bruised ego and a visible bump to match. Despite the clear rejection, Jim remained fixated on Janis, his fascination seemingly deepened by her refusal to entertain him. Janis, however, had no patience for his antics and firmly shut down any chance of a future relationship. She even refused to let Paul give Jim her number. Even though Jim reportedly tried to reach out, the two never reconciled.
Oh, Jim.
Buddy, don't piss off a Southern woman.
Oh, man. I don't know. I feel like Jim Morrison probably couldn't comprehend getting turned away by someone.
Yup.
Mm-hmm. This might have been the only time in his life this happened.
Other highlights from this era include Big Brother's performances at San Francisco's Winterland Ballroom and at the Carousel Ballroom in April and May of 68, respectively. Both became live albums. I also, back here, if I can get it out, because it's at a really weird angle, as are most things, and I don't want to bend this, but for Black Friday Record Store Day, they put out Big Brother at the Grandy Ballroom in Detroit.
Fantastic.
And some of this is on the Cheap Thrills Deluxe Edition because they recorded some at the Winterland, I think, and a little bit at the Grandy. We'll get into this more later. But Big Brother at the Grandy is how the phrase Kick Out the Jams was coined.
That's so cool.
Yeah, the five were heckling Sam Andrew, it was.
Yeah.
Because he was, like, messing up a really simple chord change. And they were like, get off the stage, man. Kick out the jams or get off the stage. And then Kick Out the Jams just stuck. So thank you, Big Brother.
Thank you so much.
On July 31st, 1968, Janis made her television debut on ABC's This Morning, hosted by Dick Cavett. Although the original tapes were lost, the audio survives. Later, Janis would make three appearances on Cavett's own primetime show. Because her career was so short, there aren't many TV interviews with Janis, but her appearances on Dick Cavett showcase a funny and witty young woman, hungry for life and all it had to offer.
Just a quick information here, all of these clips are available on YouTube, and it's only 10 minutes per interview, I think, but it is incredible. Mm. I highly recommend you to watch it. It really gives you such an insight on how she was thinking and who she kind of was, how she tried to present herself. But there's also this really genuine energy between her and Dick that makes for a really nice interview.
Mutual respect.
Yeah, they kind of like kick off each other.
Yeah.
By mid-1968, the band was billed as Janis Joplin and Big Brother and the Holding Company, creating tensions within the group. Critics like Time magazine hailed Janis as, quote, the most powerful singer to emerge from the white rock movement, and Richard Goldstein of Vogue described her as, quote, the most staggering leading woman in rock, clutching the knees of a final stanza, begging it not to leave. Fans and critics urged Janis to move on, emphasizing her potential outside the band. Cheap Thrills, their second album, marked a peak, but also revealed challenges. Producer John Simon struggled to capture the band's energy in live recordings, leading to frustration for Janis, who delivered polished vocals. Elliot Mazur refined the tracks, giving the album a raw sound despite most of it being studio recorded. The artwork by Robert Crumb and hits like Piece of My Heart and Summertime solidified its iconic status. Released in August 1968, Cheap Thrills reached number one on the Billboard 200 and went gold. In the summer of 1968, Janis decided to leave Big Brother after their East Coast tour and key performances, including the Newport Folk Festival. On September 14th of 1968, the band played their publicized farewell concert at Fillmore West, although they continued touring into the fall. Janis' final performance with Big Brother, Brief Reunions in 1970, was at a Chet Helms benefit in San Francisco on December 1st, 1968. After leaving Big Brother, Janis formed the Cosmic Blues Band, featuring musicians like keyboardist Steven Ryder, saxophonist Cornelius Snooky Flowers, and former Big Brother guitarist Sam Andrew, and future Full Tilt Boogie Band bassist Brad Campbell. Influenced by Stax Records and artists like Otis Redding, the Cosmic Blues Band adopted a funky, pop-oriented style, contrasting with the era's psychedelic rock. As her career soared, so did her addiction. By early 1969, she was reportedly using up to $200 worth of heroin daily. That is over $1,600 in today's money.
Ugh.
Producer Gabrielle Meckler, who worked with her on I Got the Mole Cosmic Blues Again, Mama, took steps to keep Janis off drugs during the June of 1969 recording sessions. He later shared with biographer Myra Friedman that Janis stayed at his Los Angeles home to distance herself from drugs and drug-using friends. It must have been so hard in that scene at that time to not take drugs.
Mm-hmm. See, I don't know when the tipping point exactly was, but it was sometime after LSD was outlawed.
Yes. And it's so interesting because I experienced it still kind of the same, at least in the movie circles. Cocaine is still huge on movie sets. And even though obviously it is illegal and people for sure know how harming it could be, it's still a big thing. I have worked at multiple sets where people would just blandly offer you cocaine. Gets you through the long days, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, I feel for her so deeply because she so early on recognized that she had a problem, but it almost feels like she did not stand a single chance to actually work on it.
I'd say in a music industry like nowadays, where you can just make music from your home or even your bedroom, and you can limit touring, but you can still reach a lot of people, that would have been really good for Janis to be in a more controlled environment so she could have that life without quite all of the indulgences. The Cosmic Blues Band toured through Europe. The film Janis captures moments like their arrival in Frankfurt. Janis is shown waiting inside her bus before a gig, and an American fan comes on the bus to tell her how much he loves her. This was just the beginning of the chaos. With no security present, the stage in Frankfurt got so crowded that by the end of the concert, band members couldn't see each other. That was a thing you would do in the 60s, you know, all the free love, man, now everybody come up on stage and dance with us. Play whatever instrument. But it got pretty chaotic up there. Released in September 1969, I Got Them Old Cosmic Blues Again, Mama reached number 5 on the Billboard charts and was certified gold that year. However, it received mixed reviews. Ralph J. Gleason of the San Francisco Chronicle criticized the band, calling it a drag and suggesting Janis should scrap the group and return to Big Brother, quote, if they'll have her. Conversely, Carl Bernstein of the Washington Post praised Cosmic Blues, writing that Janis had, quote, finally assembled a group of first-rate musicians with whom she is totally at ease and whose abilities complement the incredible range of her voice. The single Cosmic Blues peaked at number 41 in the US, while a live version of Raise Your Hand became a top 10 hit in Germany. Then came Janis's performance at Woodstock.
Just
It's the stuff of rock and roll legend. She played at about 2 o'clock in the morning on Sunday, as everything was running late. Her gig was pushed back for hours. Unfortunately, she spent that time backstage drinking and using heroin, as many of the acts did. Jefferson Airplane went on stage whacked out of their minds. Pretty sure everyone did. And Janis was using with her friend and occasional lover, Peggy Caserta. Despite Janis's hoarse voice and struggles to dance, she engaged with the crowd. She asked them if they were okay, which is really sweet. And of course, she asked if they were, quote, staying stoned.
How are you out there? Are you okay? You're not, yeah, you're staying stoned and you got enough water and you got a place to sleep and everything. What does that mean?
Oh, the 60s. The encore was, of course, Ball and Chain. About that night, Pete Townsend of The Who said, quote, "Even Janis on an off night was incredible." Janis stayed for the rest of the festival. Joining other artists backstage, she stood behind Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young during their debut performance and sat in Joe Cocker's van with Joan Baez to watch Jimi Hendrix. A meeting of the minds.
Yeah. Janis had an on-again, off-again romantic relationship with Peggy Caserta, which began after the two met in November of 1966, when Big Brother and the Holding Company played at the Matrix in San Francisco. Peggy, one of only 15 attendees, ran a boutique in Haight-Ashbury called Menazedica? Maybe Menazedica? I don't think it's an actual word, but it sounds kind of funky. Where Janis, unable to afford a $5 pair of jeans, asked to put down a 50-cent deposit. Peggy, impressed by Janis' talent, gave her the jeans for free. Their friendship remained platonic for over a year, even as Peggy had romantic feelings for Big Brother guitarist Sam Andrew. When her relationship with Andrew fizzled out in 1968, Janis emphasized with her. By the time of Woodstock in 1969, both women had become intravenous heroin users. There are many speculations about Janis' sexuality. In the late 1960s, even amidst the free love movement, being gay still wasn't even close to normalized. She only spoke publicly about her sexuality once. It was on July 11th in 1970, while talking to her friend Richard Huntgen, the Dead's road manager, whom she had known since 1966. They were offstage during a San Diego gig for both Full Tilt Boogie and Big Brother when she said the following that he later repeated to Myra Friedman. Quote, I hear a rumor that somebody in San Francisco is spreading stories that I'm a dyke. You go back there and find out who it is and tell them that Janis says she's gotten it on with a couple of thousand cats in her life and a few hundred chicks and see what they can do with that.
You tell them.
Yes, gosh, you go.
She seems like the type of gal who wouldn't care what you look like or what you present as. Just like, if you're cool, if you vibe, if you have a great personality, you're gonna hit it off.
Yes.
That's free love, really.
Yeah. Later that year, Janis faced legal issues when she was arrested for using, quote, vulgar and indecent language during a concert in Tampa, Florida. She yelled at police officers, "Don't fuck with those people," and was released on a $504 bond. At her trial, she was found guilty and fined $200 plus court costs. Janis also encountered difficulties at Madison Square Garden, including an infamous duet with Tina Turner during a Rolling Stones concert, where she was described as, quote, so drunk, so stoned, so out of control that she seemed like, quote, an institutionalized psychotic rant by mania, according to Myra Friedman in her book Buried Alive, the biography of Janis Joplin. Reflecting on her performances, Janis told journalist David Dalton that audiences at larger venues like Madison Square Garden watched her with, quote, is she gonna make it in their eyes? She admitted to feeling most comfortable performing in smaller counterculture venues in San Francisco. Despite her success, Janis struggled with loneliness and substance abuse. Her performances reflected her emotional vulnerability, something that resonated deeply with audiences. Yet the disconnect between her public image and personal struggles weighed heavily on her. Her career continued to soar, but her life remained tumultuous.
By June of 1970, Janis had performed in the Bay Area for what would be the last time. Sam Andrew returned to Big Brother in late summer 1969, and at the end of that year, the Cosmic Blues Band dissolved. Their final performance was at Madison Square Garden with Johnny Winter and Paul Butterfield. In February 1970, Janice traveled to Brazil for a much-needed break. Janice was accompanied by her friend Linda. She designed Janice's stage costumes. While in Brazil, Janice met David Nyhaus, a tourist and former Peace Corps member from Cincinnati. In photos taken during their time at Carnival in Rio, Janice and David appear to be just a carefree couple enjoying a vacation. It was Janice's escape from the pressures of fame. In an interview for Rolling Stone, Janice described her break, saying she was, quote, going into the jungle with a big bear of a beatnik named David Nyhaus, and that she had, quote, decided to go and dig some other jungles for a couple of weeks. During this time, Janice worked on kicking her heroin addiction. David wasn't into drugs, and according to biographer Ellis Ambern, that was really good for Janice. But upon returning to the US, the relationship fell apart. Janice refused to take a break from performing to travel with David. Then she relapsed. Her relationship with David quickly ended when he caught her using at home. The situation was further complicated by Janice's ongoing relationship with Peggy. After the breakup, Janice formed a new group. They were first called the Main Squeeze, then the Full Tilt Boogie Band. It featured young Canadian musicians who'd previously worked with Ronnie Hawkins. Full Tilt featured an organ, but no horn section this time. Janice had a more hands-on role with Full Tilt. She proudly declared, quote, "It's my band. Finally, it's my band." The Full Tilt Boogie Band began touring in 1970 and received more positive reviews than Cosmic Blues did. Many noted the strong chemistry between Janice and her new guys.
In the spring of 1970, Janice reunited with Big Brother at the Fillmore West in San Francisco for a final performance, with recordings included in Janice in Concert. On April 12th, she performed with the band again at Winterland, where both she and Big Brother were in excellent form. A few weeks later, on May 21st, she performed at a Hell's Angels event in San Rafael with the Full Tilt Boogie Band, under the alias Main Squeeze. Tensions arose as her old and new band shared the venue. Big Brother Sam Andrew felt her performance lacked the edge she had in her prime, though Nick Gravenites described her singing as stupendous. The Festival Express tour, held from June 28th to July 4th of 1970, marked some of her finest performances. Highlights included a legendary Calgary set where she jammed with Jerry Garcia and delivered a powerful rendition of Tell Mama. Later, an iconic MTV video. During this period, she began wearing multicolored feather boas in her hair, having parted ways with costume designer Linda Gravenites due to her ongoing drug use. In August, she made headlines by financing a gravestone for blues legend Bessie Smith, honoring the artist she credited with sparking her love for music. On August 8, she introduced the song Mercedes-Benz at the Capitol Theater in Port Chester, New York. Co-written with Bob Neuwirth and inspired by Michael McClure's poem, it was one of her final live performances. On August 14th, Janice attended her high school reunion in Port Arthur with Neuwirth, road manager John Cook, and her sister Laura. The experience was reportedly unpleasant, and during a press conference, she replied to reporters' questions about entertaining at Thomas Jefferson High School by saying, quote, "Only when I walk down the aisle."
That's such a bummer. Like, you go back thinking that...
I feel so, too.
At least everyone's going to be nice to you this time around, or... not treat you like you don't exist, but that's such a bummer.
Yeah, but I also think it is interesting because she was really famous at that time, but also only in these kind of circles, in these artistic San Francisco music circles, and she probably wasn't as popular in Port Arthur. Mm-hmm. People in Port Arthur probably did not buy Big Brother records. And so I feel like she led this entire life in San Francisco and California, but back home, nothing probably really changed.
It was never the place for her anyway.
And I feel like she knew that from the beginning. She knew from the beginning that Texas just wasn't for her.
Even though she tried to make it work, it just didn't. Festival yeah. Express is also a documentary, and it's really cool because it's just like three or four of the most famous bands of the 60s all on this literal train together, touring the country. It's like something out of a play, honestly. From August through early October 1970, Janis and her band spent time rehearsing and recording a new album in LA, this time working with producer Paul Rothchild. This album was to be called Pearl and would include her biggest hit, a cover of Kris Kristofferson and Fred Foster's Me and Bobby McGee. The history of the song is quite interesting. We've only mentioned it briefly before. Long before he was Mr. Rita Coolidge, Kris Kristofferson was a struggling young songwriter and aspiring actor. He wrote Me and Bobby McGee in early 1970. He'd recently moved to Nashville to pursue music, and his life was a mix of struggling with his own ambitions and trying to make a living. He was working for a record company when its president called him and asked him to write a song called Me and Bobby McGee. Who was Bobby McGee? The president's secretary, Barbara. Kris misheard her last name over the phone, hence Mickey. Kris was out of money at the time and didn't know what to do with his life. He'd just divorced his first wife, Frances, so the line, freedom's just another word for nothing left to lose, came easily. Although the song was first recorded by Roger Miller, it was Janis's version that won people's hearts. Pearl's opening track, Move Over, was written by Janis. It reflected how she felt about men treating women in relationships. The album also includes instrumental track, Buried Alive in the Blues. Janis was scheduled to add her vocals, but this was before she passed.
Janis checked herself into the Landmark Motor Hotel in Hollywood on August 24th, 1970, near Sunset Sound Records, where she began rehearsing and recording her album. During this time, she continued a relationship with Seth Morgan, a 21-year-old UC Berkeley student and cocaine dealer who had visited her home in Lanxburg in July and August. They were engaged to be married in early September, but Seth only visited Sunset Sound Records for 8 of Janis's many sessions. He stayed at Janis's Lanxburg home while she stayed alone on the Landmark. Although she visited him several times and kept an eye on the renovation happening at home. One of the projects was designing a carport shaped like a flying saucer, and the foundation for it was poured the day before Janis' death. I would have loved to see that thing. Peggy Caserta, whom we've talked about briefly earlier, claimed in her 1973 book Going Down with Janis that she and Janis had mutually agreed to stay apart in April 1970 to avoid enabling each other's drug use. By September of the same year, Peggy had become involved and smuggling cannabis throughout California and checked into the Landmark, which was known to attract drug users. Janis didn't initially know that Peggy was in Los Angeles, but learned of her presence when a heroin dealer who made deliveries to the hotel informed her. Janis begged Peggy for heroin, and when Peggy refused, Janis reportedly said, quote, "Don't think if you can get it, I can get it. Don't think if you can get it, I can't get it." By this point, Janis had become a regular customer of the same heroin dealer who had been supplying Peggy. In the winter of 1970, Janis' manager Albert Grossman and his assistant and publicist Myra Friedman had staged an intervention with her while she was in New York. By September, they knew Janis was staying at a hotel in Los Angeles, but were unaware that it had become a gathering place for drug users and dealers. Grossman and Myra knew that Peggy was a heroin user, but had no idea that she had recently rekindled her connection with Janis. During this period, Janis spent much of her time at Sunset Sound Records and enjoyed driving her Porsche on the winding roads of Sunset Boulevard, often exceeding the speed limit. According to Janis' attorney, Robert Gordon, she was known for her reckless driving, though only one member of Full Tilt Boogie Band, Ken Pearson, was ever willing to ride with her.
On September 26th, 1970, Janis recorded vocals for Half Moon and Cry Baby. During the session, she and her bandmates made a special one-minute recording for John Lennon as a 30th birthday gift. Janis, with drummer Clark Pearson, sang Happy Trails. Janice's last recording took place on October 1st when she completed Mercedes-Benz in a single take. On October 3rd, she visited Sunset Sound to listen to Buried Alive in the Blues. Later that day, she learned Seth Morgan had invited other women to her home. He was shooting pool with them using her pool table. She reportedly was quite angry about this, and rightfully so, but she was also excited about the progress of sessions. She felt good about this record. Janice and Clark left the studio together. She drove them both to Barney's Beanery in West Hollywood. She had two screwdrivers there. According to Bennett Glotzer, her manager's business partner, Janice had a friendly conversation with a fan. After midnight, Janice drove Clark and this fan back to the Landmark. When they arrived, Janice opened up to Clark about her fear that he and the rest of Full Tilt Boogie would stop playing with her. The last person to see Janice alive was the night shift desk clerk at the Landmark. He'd only met her a few times, their conversations never long enough to know her well.
On the evening of Sunday, October 4th, 1970, Janice Joplin was found dead on the floor of her room at the Landmark Motor Hotel by her road manager and close friend John Byrne Cook. Alcohol was present in the room, but reports indicated no other drugs or paraphernalia were found. However, in a 1983 book written by Joseph DeMona and Los Angeles County Coroner Thomas Nagoshi, it was revealed that evidence of narcotics had been initially removed from the scene by a friend of Janice. This person later returned the evidence after realizing that an autopsy would reveal narcotics in her system. The book mentions that Nagoshi had encountered similar cases where friends believed they were helping by removing evidence of drugs, only to return it once they realized an autopsy was forthcoming. An autopsy performed by Nagoshi confirmed that Janice died of a heroin overdose, which may have been exacerbated by alcohol. John Byrne Cook believed that Janice had obtained heroin more potent than what she and other LA users had previously encountered, pointing to overdoses among several other customers of her dealer that same weekend. Her death was ultimately ruled accidental. A newspaper clipping from October 5th of 1970 reported the news of her passing. Both Peggy Caserta and Seth Morgan failed to meet her on October 2nd, the Friday before her death. Peggy stated that Janice was deeply saddened by their absence. During the 24 hours that followed, Peggy did not reach out to explain why she hadn't shown up. She later admitted to waiting until the Saturday night to contact the Landmark switchboard, only to find out that Janice had instructed the desk clerk not to accept incoming calls for her after midnight. Her fiancé did speak to Janice by phone within the 24 hours before her death, but details about their conversation remain unclear. Janice was at Sunset Sound Records at the time, and those present, including 20 to 25 people, according to biographer Myra Friedman, noticed that whatever Seth Morgan said seemed to anger her.
But instead the result of a head injury she sustained after the hourglass heel of her slingback sandal got caught in the carpet, causing her to lose her balance. Peggy has acknowledged, however, that drugs or alcohol may have contributed to hastening Janice's death. I get it. It can be hard to cope when somebody you love passes away and drugs are involved.
I feel like she felt guilty too. Not only because she left her alone, but also because the moment that she stepped back into Janice's life, she knew what that meant for her. Janice's death shocked the music world, coming just a month after Ken Heath's Alan Wilson and 16 days after Jimi Hendrix, all of whom were 27 at the time. The coincidence led to the creation of the 27 Club mythology.
In wake of Janice's passing, two books released in 1973 drew significant attention, Buried Alive by her publicist Myra Friedman, and Peggy's Going Down with Janice. The latter included some provocative claims about Janice's personal life and graphic descriptions of drug use and sexual encounters. Peggy's portrayal of Janice is one of many in a larger narrative about the troubled lives of those close to the singer. Many of her friends and colleagues struggled with addiction after her death, including James Gurley of Big Brother. He didn't achieve sobriety until years after Janice passed. Peggy eventually published a new memoir, I Ran Into Some Trouble, which offers a more nuanced account of her relationship with Janice. It seems Peggy's made efforts to distance herself from the sensationalism of her previous book, and rightfully so.
I would love to get my hands on a copy of Going Down with Janice, even though I know that it largely is just a myth and a lot of the stories in there aren't even true.
And a cash grab.
Yes, but I still think it is such an interesting piece of history. However, these are really, really rare and I did not come by a copy that sold for less than $500 so far. Mm-hmm. Several artists honored Janis after her death, including the Mamas and the Papas with their song Pearl, Leonard Cohen's Chelsea Hotel No. 2, and Robert Hunter's Bird Song by Jerry Garcia. Patti Smith also wrote a song for her, Lullaby, I Was Working Real Hard, which she performed in 1975. Additionally, Janis was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 1995, with Kris Kristofferson playing Me and Bobby McGee for her. Another word for nothing left to lose. Nothing, I mean nothing, hon, if it ain't free. Yeah, feeling good was easy, love, when he sang the blues. You know, feeling good was good enough for me. Good enough for me and my Bobby, yeah. We'd like to end this episode with Janis reflecting on music in an interview from 1969.
How about the folks in small town Texas? How did they feel about you setting out to sing and do the blues?
Well, they thought I was completely insane. They didn't like me, no. Because you see, and you know how small towns are. You're supposed to get married when you get out of high school and have a brood of children and keep your mouth shut, you know. And I didn't do any of those things. They still haven't figured me out. I think that the society is moving a little bit, but I mean, you know, I think it is moving near that fast. You know, there's always going to be a large, huge bulk of straight people, you know, that aren't going for it.
Thanks for tuning in to this episode of Unveiling the Legends, Dolls of the 60s and 70s. We hope you enjoyed our journey through the life of the wonderful Janis Joplin.
As always, we're Emma
and Abby,
your hosts, and we're thrilled to have you with us on this groovy adventure. Remember that the spirit of these trailblazing ladies lives on in each one of us, inspiring us to embrace our individuality, creativity, and passion for change.
If you like what you heard, don't forget to subscribe to, rate, and review our podcast on your favorite streaming platform. Your feedback means the world to us, and it helps others discover the magic of these legendary dolls.
As always, we'd like to thank special friend of the show, Michael Teggio, for the wonderful intro song. Until next time, keep the music loud, the fashion groovy, and the spirit of the 60s and 70s alive in your hearts.
Peace,
love,
and rock and roll.